from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Who would have guessed this audience would be so enthusiastic about the co-founder of ISIS?
She has an entire media empire that constantly demonizes Donald Trump and fails to point out that she hasn't had a press conference in 300 days, 200 days, 100 days, I don't know how long. Fails to point out several signs of illness by her.
The Clintons never took a nickel out of the foundation. In fact, they gave $1 million.
On the one hand, it's part of the wacky strategy. Just say all these crazy things and maybe you can get some people to believe you. On the other hand, it just absolutely makes no sense.
Some news of the week out of context. We'll try to make some sense today on The Wheelhouse. I'm going to try really hard today not to talk about the Republican presidential candidate, in part because all of us in the media are talking just too much about him, but also because we've created a bit of an unusual situation here in which Hillary Clinton, one of the most powerful and objectively interesting political figures of our time, seems to be flying somewhat under the radar toward November, even as she stages a historic campaign as the first woman to head up a major party ticket and as she faces a long list of controversies and questions. Here to help ask and answer some questions today is Colin McEnroe. He's host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Bill Curry is here. He's our Democratic political analyst and a former advisor to Bill Clinton. Hello, Bill.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And Leah Wright-Rigger, she's an assistant professor of public policy at Harvard University. She's always on television these days, but now she's on the radio with us, so it's so good to see you, Leah.
Oh, it's always wonderful to be here, John.
You can join us in the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Colin, let's just start with the notion that the media is avoiding all of these Hillary Clinton stories, and there are many, many of them, because there's always something on television interesting to say about Donald Trump. I mean, are we giving Hillary Clinton a big pass toward November?
You just said Donald Trump.
Damn it!
You went a minute and a half, John.
Right. So, a lot of this has to do with, first of all, I don't think the media is entirely avoiding these stories, particularly not over the last 7 days. I think these stories have really risen to the fore. But, you know, she herself has adopted in both the primary and the general cycle a kind of a rope-a-dope strategy, right? You lean back on the ropes and you let your opponent punch himself out until he's tired. And it didn't make sense to be throwing haymakers at Bernie Sanders because she knew she would need those people. You know, she couldn't alienate Bernie Sanders supporters too much. So she didn't take very many punches at him. And in the case of Donald Trump, she hasn't taken very many punches at him because he does such a great job of creating negative news cycles about himself. Even when she's about to have a negative news cycle, he will start tweeting stuff that has nothing to do with the problem that she has right now. He has repeatedly done her tremendous favors by just taking away the thing that in fact might be a problem. And so what her strategy has been is she makes the rounds, she goes to her rallies, she gives the same speech every time. I'll just quickly say there was a documentary about paparazzi, and Matt Damon in it was explaining why he's not covered by the paparazzi very much. He goes, I don't make a lot of news, you know, I'm married, I got a couple of kids. I don't really do very much. Every once in a while, they need to find me and update the picture a little bit. So it'll be, other than that, there's no real reason to go looking for me. She's kind of got a Matt Damon strategy a little bit. Like, why create too much news about yourself when, in fact, the other guy is imploding?
I like the Matt Damon strategy. Bill, what do you think about this?
Leave it to Colin to see the parallels between Hillary Clinton and Matt Damon. But I think, first of all, Hillary's been running a kind of Boo Radley campaign right from the beginning. If you remember when she started her campaign, there were a handful of staged events. You know, getting her to come out was very difficult. She's had, famously now, one press conference in almost a year. The staged events were with people who were very carefully selected. The press wasn't even often there for them but got summaries afterward, et cetera, et cetera. And she would prefer to run a campaign which is what she's out financing right now. She'd prefer to run a campaign which is all media, all paid stuff, all orchestrated, all pretested. And how she spent the last 2 weeks is in private raising lots of money in order to fund that. And so I think that's, you know, it probably is to her advantage. You know, again, she – I don't want to engage in a false equivalency between her and you know.
Much better than me.
In a way, it's like it's apples and oranges. And, of course, Trump is the orange. What they've done in terms of corruption, in terms of lying, in terms of all the things that this campaign has sadly devolved into a debate over,
his record is just extraordinarily and by orders of magnitude worse than hers.
But one thing, Leah, though, that I want to get at today, and I will say this is a little bit of soul searching on my part. It's certainly a lot of feedback that we're getting, and just my sense of how, as I listen to, say, NPR, as I watch many of the 24-hour cable news channels, you do have a candidate in Hillary Clinton who in any other year would be under enormous scrutiny, far beyond, frankly, the scrutiny of just the last 7 days over her emails, over the Clinton Foundation, over her record, over some of the things that she has said years past that have now turned out to be not necessarily true. Look, this is someone who we would be vetting, to use a Donald Trump phrase, in a much different way were she not up against Donald Trump.
Right. And so that's the dilemma. And so I think I agree with Bill that this is apples and oranges. But that still means that we have to evaluate the apples, right, just to make sure. And I think one of the things that we've talked about in here, we've talked about other places, is that one of Hillary Clinton's points, selling points, is how good she is at policy or how good she is at explaining or understanding, right, and conveying that. And so even as she's been out fundraising, as she's been doing these kind of smaller rallies, we haven't heard much of that. I mean, I hesitate to use this phrase because I know that it has been abused over and over again by the other guy. But, you know, the question really is, where is Hillary right now? This is a perfect opportunity for her to be selling her platform and her campaign and really outlining to the American public, this is what I have to offer you.
Colin, let's get to a few of these issues, though, that we do want to talk about today. And throughout the course of the program, maybe we'll get a chance to talk about some of those policies and issues and the things that maybe she's not talking about as much as she could. You can join us if you have a thought. 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. This week, a federal judge told Clinton that the State Department has until late September to figure out how they're going to release about 15,000 new emails and documents. Not exactly ideal timing for an email dump. She's playing it cool, though. Here she is talking to Jimmy Kimmel on Monday.
The State Department, I actually added it up today, and the State Department said that they have to release 15,000 emails by the deadline is a couple of days before the debate. Are you concerned about that?
No. No, I mean,
I would be terrified if my emails were released.
But, I mean, Jimmy, my emails are so boring.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm embarrassed about that. They're so boring. And so we've already released, 30,000 plus. So what's a few more?
So at the end, you're not concerned that there's going to be something that Donald Trump is able to use against you, that the Republicans, that comes in at the last second.
But he makes up stuff to use against us. So if he would stick with reality, I wouldn't have a worry in the world.
Have you ever sent him an email?
No.
You have not? No. Okay. Well, that would be some plot twist to this.
No, I think
So Jimmy Kimmel and Hillary Clinton downplaying the emails. I mean, how much should we be downplaying these emails? I mean, just before the debate, Colin, it's not like this isn't going to give us something to talk about, even if they are boring.
Right. So let's back up and say that many of the things are surrounding this scandal, or if it's a scandal, this issue anyway, are things we have to take on trust. There's 30,000 or 31,000 emails we'll never see that were destroyed. They're supposedly about yoga and other quote-unquote boring stuff. But we pretty much have to take on faith that those emails are boring and that they're not germane. This other 15,000 or this new tranche of emails is – first of all, one thing you have to say about it is, the judge may decide how to vet it and when to trickle it out, and may have to go through the FBI and or state before it trickles out in mid-October. But I assume that anything that they have, Julian Assange has too. And, Julian Assange is another example. Hillary Clinton has been so lucky in her enemies. Her opponent is, if it comes down to which one of us is a more horrible person, she is going to prevail in that contest because he's a more horrible person. And Julian Assange, who also hates her and has openly declared war on her, is turning into a Bond villain before our eyes. All he needs is a white cat in his lap, And he's doing stuff like releasing all this personal data about people that's he's just too lazy to redact from the stuff. So whatever's in these emails, I would predict we'll see them sooner than the formal vetting process would dictate, because I assume Assange is either going to get them or he already has them, and he's going to blast them out whenever he wants to.
Bill?
First of all, I agree that just because it's apples, it doesn't mean it doesn't need to be investigated. And it's a great liability of Hillary Clinton that
confronted with a person such as Trump, who has such a self-evidently horrible character, who's probably the greatest serial liar in the history of American public life, whose entire life is a fraud and whose politics does border on the fascistic, the problem for her is that there are a lot of these things she can't raise because she's not the best messenger to talk about character, talk about honesty, and she's sort of frozen there. It's also the great tragedy here, though, is that this is what we're talking about. We have three overarching issues: climate change, which threatens the survival of the planet, the survival of the middle class, and the survival of the democracy. If you ever want to talk about what makes an election important, when the choice is stark, as it is here, and the issues are urgent, and we are truly in crisis, as we are now on all three of those things, and there's not even room to get back to them. In the primaries, we talked about the rigged system, and at the convention, even that stopped. It just stopped, and now we're just sort of caught in this.
But you have been raising, and certainly you've been raising this for years. Bernie Sanders, over the course of the last year, has been raising this as an issue, Bill, that public corruption, the sense that we cannot trust the people who lead us, is one of the most important things that we need to tackle in American society. Not down the list of all sorts of other things, including right. climate change and the economy, but it's really up there. And the fact is, as you said, Hillary Clinton has not given herself the room to be able to counter the Republican candidate on issues of trustworthiness, the ability to say, I am going to do what I say I'm going to do. I'm going to release publicly available information to the public. These are all things that we care about and things that you've said are very, very important. Shouldn't they be higher up on the list of all the possible things?
I believe it is the most important problem because it's the problem that keeps us from solving all the others, the corruption of the democracy. So for me, it is number one. The problem is that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about whether Hillary is a more corrupt person than Trump, not about whether the entire system is corrupt. Take the email example. From what you've seen, Trump calling for a special prosecutor when there is no evidence of any violation of the law and any disclosure so far. Zero, zip, nothing. So you're not going to have a special prosecutor. The problem is that what's most wrong with our system isn't illegal. The problem is that the corruption of this of American politics has been legalized and systematized. And that's what we need to have at the center of this discussion. But it's not. Even that is in effect crowded out by the conversation we're having over who's a better person. Is Hillary more corrupt or Trump more crazy? What an awful debate to be having at such an important time.
Aaliyah?
Completely agree. Why are we having this debate? You know, I think the American public, I mean, when we look at polls and we look at historical polls, public confidence in our two-party system is at its lowest that it's been in years. People think that the system is rigged on both sides of the aisle. And I think with the email thing, what it ultimately does, along with kind of the exposure in the case of the DNC moment, is it further undermines the credibility that Hillary Clinton has in her trying to sell herself and her message. With that being said, the public doesn't have very much faith in Donald Trump either. So I think, you know, we're at this moment where it's really like, okay, again, who is more corrupt? Since these are our choices, how about we actually talk about the things that, I don't know, that actually matter?
One of the things that I think is going to be a struggle, to Bill's point about sort of there's three crises and the third one is our democracy. You know, when this is all over, which it eventually will be, believe it or not, when this election cycle is
not
over.
Soon enough.
Yeah, I think there is going to be a certain amount of garment rending about this. You know, I mean, how out of 318 million people did these two people become our choices? People with high negatives. I mean, we used to complain it's just a big popularity contest. It's not even that anymore. We have like two unpopular people running for president. How did that happen? But the problem is that on each side, they have a different problem. The correction is different for each side. For the Republicans, the problem was, in some ways, the process wasn't rigged enough, that they didn't have enough control over the process. So this rather, you know, demographically kind of small cadre of Donald Trump maniacs hijacked their primary process and won, you know, won fair and square. And so they're looking at this thinking, you know, we should have more super delegates. We should have like all this stuff they have over on the Democratic side so this wouldn't happen to us. And of course, over on the Democratic side, I mean, there is this sense that it's over-rigged, over-controlled, that there was never intended to be any choice at all. Bernie Sanders was an unanticipated introduction into this process. Otherwise, it just would have been a complete layup. And that's wrong too. So I think there'll be pressure over on the Democratic side to open up the process more, you know, and create other kinds of opportunities so we don't have this dynastic, you know, Juan and Eva Perón scenario that we're thrust at us now.
And let me just say, giving the Republican National Committee PAC, which is what it is, even more control over the Democratic process, I agree with Colm. It'll be a popular solution among Republicans, but not a really good answer. I'd just like to point out, when you think about what I want to go back to something I said earlier about the primaries, Bernie Sanders, a 74-year-old Jewish self-identified socialist that no one had ever heard of, came really within a hair's breadth, I'd argue, of beating the entire Clinton machine. Donald Trump destroyed the Republican Party, and the main theme of each of those campaigns was that the system is rigged. And that was all you heard. When you got to the conventions, the Republican Party platform doesn't contain a single clause, not one syllable, pertaining to the question of how the system is rigged and what you do to fix it. There's nothing about ethics reform. And the Democrats took out the language they'd had historically about revolving doors, no-bid contracts, defending whistleblowers, expanding freedom of information. All of that was ripped out, leaving only their sort of hollow cry to overturn Citizens United. And so the fact that these two parties at the top are so completely uncommitted to the kind of reform we were talking about couldn't be any clearer. If we were having a real debate right now over those issues and over this broken system rather than over these two flawed personalities, maybe that would be back on the table.
I just want to get to a quick phone call from Peter in Stanford. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. Well, Peter, thank you very much for that. And Lee, I mean, I don't think we're going to have this enormous Jill Steiner, Gary Johnson movement, but we are looking at Gary Johnson maybe polling at somewhere just south of 10%. We're certainly seeing some Bernie supporters saying, you know, I am never going to vote for Hillary Clinton, and they're going to move over to Jill Stein. What's the impact of actually having a candidate on the progressive left and a candidate on the libertarian right to choose from?
And we also have, I guess, Evan McMillan now is now on the ballot in a couple of states and appears to be gaining in states like Utah, where he's now at 9%. But I do think this is one of those banner years for third-party candidates. And there's considerable, and I say considerable loosely, but considerable interest for third-party candidates. What we're seeing right now is that those third-party candidates are cutting a little bit more into Donald Trump than they are into Hillary Clinton. Depending, I see Bill kind of going, depending on where you're looking. But I think that the fact remains that you do have a cross-section of American people who are interested. The other area to look at that we really don't pay too much attention to are non-voters, who tend to actually be the biggest group, right, of people. There should be an investigation into why people are not voting. Why do they not come out? Why don't they participate in the electoral process? And I think it goes into a lot of what we've discussed here today, which is that people look at a two-party system and say, I don't have any choices.
Well, they look at a two-party system, say they don't have any choices. They looked at what they see as a rigged system, and they don't have any choices. They look at a system, Colin, where it somehow gives them candidates that have such enormous unfavorable ratings, as you said before. It's not even a popularity contest they can choose from.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the irony here is that, as Bill and Leah have been saying, we're kind of mired in this conversation about the character of these two major party candidates. We have no such problems with these third and fourth party candidates. So we get to look at their policies. And then it turns out their policies either are terrible or don't make any sense. I mean, Jill Stein's an awful candidate. I mean, she's awful in every possible way. I mean, she's a doctor who can't, you know, emphatically endorse vaccinations. She's somebody who's basically, I mean, I think the highest election she's ever won was a municipal one in Newton, Massachusetts. She's lost like state representative races. She's got this quantitative easing proposal for college debt that is completely inscrutable, even to her. She's unable to explain it when pressed on it. I mean, the idea that the Green Party, which really wants to be this kind of viable, reform-minded progressive party, can't come up with a better candidate than Jill Stein, they should hang their heads in as much shame as the Republicans and the Democrats. At least Johnson and Weld, they're both people who have governed. They've governed states. That's the Libertarian ticket. Now, when you actually read what the Libertarian ticket believes, it's hard to see how they're the right people to address the problems that we're facing as a nation right now. But so when you look at their policies, there's a little bit of a problem with them, too. But, you know, the other thing to remember about third parties is, and I'm fine with third parties, but just remember what our system is like. And I don't think it would happen in this cycle, but what can happen is that you could have the House of Representatives choosing the president if, in fact, third parties get too many votes. So just keep bear that in mind, whether or not you want Paul Ryan in charge of the process of choosing a U.S. president before you go all third party crazy.
First of all, I actually disagree with Colin on Jill Stein to some degree. I think she's a better candidate than he makes out. But the fact of the matter is, and I say this as probably the Democrat who spoke and wrote most emphatically against Hillary's candidacy for a year, this really is a stark choice, and it really is a systemic a crisis that we're in. And Noam Chomsky said the other day that he was going to vote for Jill Stein because he lived in Massachusetts, but if he was in a swing state, he'd vote for Hillary. And I think that doesn't go far enough. I want Donald Trump to lose by a landslide. I want this little fascist foray to be snuffed out in its crib. And so it's really important that we make this choice. 8:01 on election night, I go back into the loyal opposition. We need to build an independent progressive movement to hold these people to account. I agree with everything that my progressive friends say about the unresponsiveness of the two major parties. But this is a choice we need to make. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
All right. So I do think that's important. But I do, you know, think it's also worth considering that, and this is the conversation we keep having, is that when public trust erodes in both parties, we see a rise in the number of people registering as independents and supporting third-party movements, right? So this is rise and fall over the course of the last 50 years or so. So again, I think it's really, especially in a year like this year, where you have these two candidates, it is increasingly becoming hard for a small section of the voting population to say, you know, I am worried about this fascist candidate on the other side, and therefore I'm going to vote for this candidate that I feel is corrupt. And so we've seen an increase, I think, in the number of people who are saying, like the caller, I simply can't do that. So won't be dictated by the fear of what say a Trump presidency could be.
We're talking with Leah Wright-Rigger, who's an assistant professor of public policy at Harvard University. Bill Curry is here. He's a Democratic political analyst, once was an advisor to Bill Clinton. And Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, will consider a little bit more about Hillary Clinton's campaign, including the Clinton Foundation. We'll take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. It's coming up next in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the week's news and focusing on the Hillary Clinton campaign with Leah Wright-Rigger from Harvard University, Bill Curry, who is a Democratic political analyst and also former advisor to Bill Clinton, and Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. We're talking about Hillary Clinton this morning. Colin, what are you talking about this afternoon at 1 o'clock?
Something very different. If Hartford ever gets its baseball team, that baseball team will be controlled entirely by the Colorado Rockies. The Colorado Rockies will be in a position to call up that baseball team and say, why are you starting that guy at second base tonight? We want the other guy starting at second. It's like that. So there's this whole other world called independent baseball. And in fact, Connecticut's two other teams, the Bridgeport Bluefish and the New Britain Bees, are a part of that world of independent baseball. They're not affiliated with any team. They can do whatever they want. They assemble their own rosters right there in New Britain and Bridgeport. Sometimes they have kind of open auditions. So we're exploring that whole world. Jonathan McNichol, the producer, and I were actually at the New Britain Stadium yesterday talking to players from both the Bluefish and the Bees, and it's fun. I just, on another sports note, I just want to say one thing to CTN viewers.
Yeah.
Some woman last week saw this mug. Hey, here's the mug.
Yeah.
So and wrote to me, or she tweeted at me to ask if I'm really a Packers fan.
Oh.
Yes, I am
oh
really a Packers fan.
Wow.
Oh, boy. Here it goes. You bet he is.
I'm so glad that the person who watches us on CTN actually called in.
I've watched both preseason games. I'm very aware of, you know,
and he's
gap responsibility in the 3-4.
It's the only publicly owned major professional sports
right.
team in America.
It is indeed, the Green Bay Packers. So, of course, Colin McEnroe is with some sports talk this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show. Quickly, as we move along, let's go to Kevin in Windsor. Hey, Kevin, go ahead.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What's up?
Two things I'd like to point out. First, on the third-party candidates, is there possibly a difference between Gary Johnson taking votes away from Trump but Jill Stein actually getting people out to vote who wouldn't normally vote, therefore increasing the number of voters? And then on the Hillary's health thing, I'm wondering if that whole campaign is nothing more than a distraction, sort of like when the birthers just
couldn't get that out of the news cycle until Obama did something about it.
Well, Kevin, you raise a couple of good points. I mean, maybe we'll take the second one first and put that to you, Leah. I mean, the questions about Hillary's health are coming from, you know, people like Rudy Giuliani. They're not exactly coming from, I don't know, doctors and stuff. I mean, what do you make of controversies around Hillary Clinton's health?
It's a non-controversy. It's ridiculous. I mean, don't get me wrong. So candidates in the past, we've had things, everybody points to FDR and his health. But we're talking about, somebody who was openly, very, very sick, right? This is something different. This is actually kind of fringe politics entering into the mainstream and turning into a thing that it shouldn't be, right? Both of the candidates have given full health remarks and all of those things, and now we're finding kind of things to point out, kind of fringe ideas. And so for Giuliani to say, well, look it up, it's on the internet, is like the epitome of just how ridiculous it is that we are actually talking about Hillary Clinton's health.
Well, look it up, it's on the internet is actually a big part of the Trump campaign, I think, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, there should be a national campaign to put more horrible things about Rudy Giuliani on the internet so that when he gets Googled, they come up. But look, there's sort of three – let's say there's a taxonomy of sort of three kinds of issues. One at the top is the kind of issue that Bill and Leah have been talking about all for this whole show, things like climate change, all right? Well, to argue those points, you'd have to, A, know what your opponent thinks about climate change, and B, what you think about climate change. You'd have to be fluid about those things, something that, by the way, Donald Trump is going to need to do presumably by September 26th, which is – the first debate, assuming that he's going to debate. And then the next tier, would be issues that are legitimate issues. They're not policy issues, but something like the Clinton Foundation, where you kind of have, once again, have to know what you're talking about. You have to fly spec, some of the data. You have to kind of understand how the whole thing works so that you can have a defensible position. And then there's this other stuff, this sort of world of arcana, in which Donald Trump has preferred to traffic generally in his life. Obama isn't really born in the United States. How do you know that? Well, people know that. People know that, and this is another one of those things that you can't even have a rational argument about, because the whole point of his argument is there's something you don't know about that is being concealed from you. And therefore, I can't actually produce any proof of its opposite, because the whole point of it is it's being concealed from you. And he loves that kind of thing. That's very much the kind of thing that he likes to make. It requires the least homework, which I think is one of the reasons he likes it.
This is all true. And as we turn, though, to maybe questions about the Clinton Foundation, Bill, and what we do and don't know about the Clinton Foundation, it again raises another one of these issues where, as Hillary Clinton has said, and as we've said during this program, Donald Trump and his surrogates like to make up stuff that is just taken from the internet. But there's also plenty of stuff like the Clinton Foundation and how the foundation may or may not have allowed various foreign powers to have cozied up in some way to her as Secretary of State. I mean, this is something that we should probably look at, and we probably don't know anywhere enough about it.
Sure. I wrote in Salon over a year ago when Hillary was first announcing her campaign that they should put the foundation into the managerial equivalent of a blind trust, and announced that they would soon be ceasing all contact with it. And they didn't. And now they've said, well, if she's elected, we'll get rid of some of it. And it's still too murky. They're always more than a day late and a dollar short coming to these issues. Having said all that, and believing all that, so far what we've seen is a peek behind the curtain, but not just at the Clintons, at the entire system. Every president, vice president, senator, congressman, and governor and cabinet secretary in America has someone like Huma Abedin, who does nothing but seating arrangements for the wealthy and powerful in this country. That's why we need ethics reform. That's why we need campaign finance reform. There's absolutely – again, so far all you've seen here is an argument not against Clinton's character, but an argument for the reform of the entire system. The Clintons helped perfect pay-to-play politics. There's no question about it, but they didn't invent it. And virtually everybody in public office is playing it now, and it's killing us.
Yeah, year after you called for some of these things in Salon, the Clinton Foundation said last Thursday it won't accept foreign or corporate donations. If Hillary Clinton becomes president, Bill Clinton will stop giving paid speeches, kind of shifting things around within the foundation as of right now. That's something that political commentator James Carville is not happy about. Here he is with Anderson Cooper on Monday.
The Clinton Foundation was
A, taking no money for the Clintons, raising money from rich people, and giving it to poor people. And all of a sudden, the press has decided that we're going to go after this and shut it down. And you know what? You're probably going to be successful. And they're going to be people that are going to die because of this.
It's the whole problem, again, in Clinton world is filled with people like James Carville who don't see the conflict, who don't see that when all these wealthy and powerful people are giving money to get access to government policymaking functions, it's a bad thing for everybody. Having said that, everything else he said was true. And again, I don't want to get into false equivalency. Think about the fact that Donald Trump has spent his entire life at the intersection of business and politics bragging about buying political influence his entire life in order to make money. There is something way out of whack here, but this needs to be changed.
But this happens, Leah, concurrently with Hillary Clinton releasing tax information. And Donald Trump won't do that, but the tax returns show that she and Bill made an income of about $10.6 million in 2015, about $28 million in 2014. This is an awful lot of money for people who are in public service. I mean, Bill just said they've perfected pay-to-play politics. When that comes so close to the email scandal, it comes so close to what's happening with the Clinton Foundations and questions about it, I think it can only raise questions about how the Clintons use some of their influence that they've gathered over the course of the last quarter century in American politics to enrich themselves.
Right. And I think this is – I agree with Bill that I actually think it's a reflection of a system wherein, right, we have politicians that are very, very, very wealthy and who kind of work within this system to use money to, you know – I hate saying this word, but nefarious ends, right? Which come across as very much as part of a bigger conspiracy. Part of this is investigating what is the role of money, right, in terms of influence and power. And it's part of it is calling for very much a reform, right? And the Democratic Party in particular has said over the last 4 years that they were going to become more transparent with many of these things. But we haven't really seen that. And I think what's interesting, too, is that last night there's a politician and his name, a Republican politician on TV, and he was asked the question, you know, if you were in this situation, what would you do? And he kind of hedged and the reason why he's hedging is because this is American politics. This is very much American politics.
So, Colin, if this is very much American politics and we all agree that it needs to change, do we see change coming in the next 4 years under Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or actually anybody in either party who's going to maybe be elected? No, probably not.
No, I don't even know exactly how that particular change, at least the change that we're talking about that involves access, it's going to be a very hard change to enact. Just a few things just sort of backing up here. The Carville clip that you just played, I think the next thing he says is that people who've complained about this are going to go to hell. You know, which makes him the second Clinton surrogate to offer to send people to hell. Madeleine Albright also offered to send women to hell because they didn't vote for Hillary. I'm tired of being sent to hell by Clinton surrogates. They don't have really that kind of control over the universe. You know, with the Clinton Foundation, it's complicated, right? Because as you said, or Bill said, Carville's basically right. When this foundation is looked at, it runs in a pretty exemplary way. Overhead does not seem to be out of control. By a number of independent estimates, 89% of the money that goes there gets out somehow into something resembling a program.
Yep.
It basically does good in the world. On the other hand, when they really do kind of the audit comparing people who donate to people who get audiences with the Secretary of State when her name is Hillary Clinton, once you sort of take out the actual government actors, it's more than half of the people who got audiences with Hillary Clinton are donors. So that isn't just a little thing. That's a system. It starts to look like a system. You know, is it a horrible system that you give money to a charity that does good in the world and then you get to go see the Secretary of State? Well, there are certainly worse systems in the world. But there's something a little creepy and unsettling about it. The question is, how much of a there is there? And you know, to me, the next question is, like Bill Clinton makes a lot of money, you know, and sometimes it's like he's the honorary chancellor of some university that you've never heard of and they pay him millions of dollars. If anybody can find a third point to this triangle with the State Department at the base and the foundation at the other side of the base, if there's a third point to this triangle where actual money is coming in and giving the Clintons the $80 million net worth they have or whatever they're worth after being, according to Hillary Clinton, dead flat broke and in debt when they left the White House in 2001, then they've got a problem. But until that happens, I don't know how big a problem
I guess I'm just I'm not so quick, Bill, to say that people who give money so that they can get an audience with the Secretary of State, even if that money is going to good ends, that is not something that is very, very bad and should be taken out of politics altogether. I look at that and I say there is something truly wrong about that, because somebody's good deeds with that money is somebody else's probably not so good deeds with that money. And it's very real access that we're talking about here. Am I making too much of this?
First of all, We'll never live to see a society in which people at the top don't get more access than everybody else. But it has become so pathological in our current society. And one of the things about the Clintons and so many neoliberal types within our party and within both parties is that they think this is simply the way of the world. But actually, we've gone through periods where it was much, much better than this, even recently in American history, mid-20th century, much higher ethical standards across the board in the public sector than we have now. This is a problem. Their failure to recognize it may yet be their undoing. And if I just say one thing, add one thing, Hillary leads by 5.5 points now in the Real Clear Politics poll. Donald Trump, the media failed to vet before he'd consolidated the nomination the fact that he was an outlandish dictatorial type, that his whole life story was a fraud, and that he was emotionally unstable. And now all those things are coming forward.
But I would just
point out that if it's the third
blame
part.
Blame the media. Go ahead, Bill.
If he was just a fascist and a fraud, this election would be tied. It's only the emotional instability part, his complete lack of impulse control, that has given Hillary the rather meager 5-point lead, as I regard it, that she has right now, 5 to 6 points. And that tells us a lot about ourselves right now and a lot about how angry people are with the kind of politics that both parties have come to represent.
Well, look, in the last segment, we're going to talk a little bit about polls and also about demographics. Let's just go quickly to Jim in Cheshire. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
One of the things that you're not addressing is that how does the Republican Party feel, having made the commitment to make sure that President Obama did not have any accomplishments, so he would be a one-term president? There's an old phrase, it's very difficult to sink the other guys into the boat and keep your own afloat. And I think Donald Trump is the just rewards that the Republican Party has gotten for that.
Jim, thank you very much for your phone call. We'll leave it at that for the segment. When we come back, we'll talk a bit more with Leah Wright-Regur, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University, about some of the things that the Republican candidate has been saying about black voters and whether or not that's going to mean anything this November. Bill Curry is our Democratic political analyst. Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the week's news, really focusing on the Hillary Clinton campaign. We've been talking so much about the other guy, whose name rhymes with thump, that we haven't really spent a whole lot of time talking about Hillary Clinton's campaign. But I will say, Leah Wright-Regur, this is something in which we have to talk about both candidates and talk a little bit about voter demographics. You were part of a PBS panel on race and the race to the White House. Obviously, we want to talk about issues a little bit. But once again, Donald Trump sort of jumps in front of all the things we could talk about around issues and race. And he starts talking kind of in this weird way directly to African-American voters from the stump, but not with any African-American voters seemingly in the audience. And he's saying things like, what do you have to lose by voting for him? Because of the poverty and the terrible stuff that's happening in your cities. You've got a terrible life. Vote for me. How do you think this plays?
That is the worst pickup line ever.
yeah, right?
But I mean, there's always going to be a small cross section of African Americans that vote for the Republican Party no matter what. I mean, David Duke is winning 14% of black votes in Louisiana right now, allegedly. So we're going to see, and I think right now he's about Donald Trump's at about 7-8%. But in order to exceed historical norms for the Republican Party, which have gone, I mean, as high as 15% as low as 4% in the last 52 years, he would actually have to do something incredibly radical and revolutionary and change his history and who he is. He can't do that. So we probably won't see anything remarkable. This is very much an attempt to make Donald Trump seem like more of a compassionate, you know, Republican. And I think it's kind of a bold and crude attempt to do so.
Although I'll say compassion usually isn't, your life is terrible, really, seriously. No, it sucks. You should really vote for me. I will say, though, and you've written about this, his extremism on some of these issues has obscured some of the complexities of how race has played into Hillary Clinton's campaign for the presidency. And that's something, too, to talk about today.
Exactly. And so I think, you know, there are several things, you know, what is this? What's the saying? A broken clock can be right twice a day, right? He did bring up the fact that poverty is an issue, and it is an issue that African Americans care about. And it's one where African Americans have taken issue with Hillary Clinton. They have taken issue with Hillary Clinton on crime, although not in the way that Donald Trump speaks to it. And they have taken issue with the economy. We don't hear Hillary Clinton really talking about these things outside of, you know, the Democratic National Convention. We know that it's incorporated into her platform, but we haven't really heard that. And what's happening is that amongst young people of color, right, not amongst older people of color who are firmly in Hillary's camp, we see a loosening of the ties, kind of an alienation from the Democratic Party. And that may not have an effect this election, but in the long term, in the very long term, it is a problem of tensions that the Democratic Party does need to address.
Does it happen at all in part because of, you know, 8 years ago, Barack Obama gets a historically large African-American turnout, a historically large turnout all across the board, promises a certain number of things that clearly people in many parts of the African-American community can say right now didn't come true. My life didn't really get all that much better 8 years later after Barack Obama.
Right. So this is the interesting thing is that the Democratic Party, Barack Obama, they are right to say, well, look, these numbers have improved on an abstract. But then when we talk about it, when we look in places, for example, like Hartford, where poverty has slightly gone up, where crime has slightly gone up, things like that, where people are still living, right, as the wealth gap has widened between African-Americans and amongst black and white citizens in this country, these are very real problems that people want addressed, that people want to talk about. The number one concern, Pew found that the number one concern of African-American voters is wealth inequality, right? Also, they also care about crime. They also care about discrimination, racial bias, things like that. But these are the things, I think, for many young African-Americans who don't have, you know, who didn't know the Clintons, but understood the outcomes of that era and then went in very optimistic about the Obama presidency and had kind of some shifts. I think it is important to consider that many of these protests have happened explicitly, if you talk to the people on the ground, because of disenchantment with not just the Republican Party, but with politics at large.
You know, Toni Morrison famously called Bill Clinton America's first black president. I think that status has eroded quite a bit. I feel as though, and Leah probably has a lot more facts at hand than I do, I feel as though some of the animus that's directed at the Clintons from that era is a little bit misplaced. I mean, the incarceration spike, for example, didn't start with Clinton's crime bill. It really started with Nixon and Reagan, the war on drugs. That's when the spike really goes up, you know, and then Clinton certainly didn't help it with the crime bill. I don't think that was the goal of his crime bill. I think to a certain degree, the kind of bona fides that the Clintons did pile up with black voters hasn't been completely eroded. I would point to one thing, which is I believe Clinton's margin over Sanders among black voters was bigger than Obama's margin over Clinton when they ran against one another in a primary, which suggests to me either that Bernie Sanders was really bad at talking to African-American voters, which I think is a strong possibility, or really that the kind of some of that Clinton loyalty is still there.
3 points, one of which is that a lesson of this year is that for all we talk about the divergent politics of African-Americans and white working class voters, when you move away from issues of racial sensitivity and the cultural antagonisms on issues of political and economic reform, their ideas are almost identical. And when we put those issues at the center of the party where they belong, we'll be able to build a rainbow coalition. And The second thing is that I agree that the young will be less partisan than middle-aged and older African American voters, just like all as is true of all voters, but as is also true, they'll be more progressive. Less partisan, but more progressive. And that has the effect of aligning them with Democrats in the end if the Democrats hold up their end of the deal. And the last thing is that just as Bill Clinton held the Democratic Party together in the 90s and Barack Obama has held it together for the last 8 years, Donald Trump's holding it together now. And as soon as he's gone, the war over basic values within the Democratic Party is going to break out because it has to.
A quick thought, Leah?
Right. So bingo. And I didn't mean to suggest that there was any significant erosion of kind of loyalty of African Americans to the Democratic Party. We actually see in states and battleground states like Florida, Georgia now, right, Virginia, that African Americans are actually making the difference for Hillary Clinton, right, significantly.
No question.
Right. But what I think is that African Americans, black voters in particular, do, as Bill say, want to see several specific things incorporated into the nexus of Democratic politics. And so that, I think, after this election is where we'll see these kind of these battle lines draw and these tensions play out, especially in the event that African Americans help Hillary Clinton win victory or win a path to the White House. This is saying our vote matters. Now, what are you going to do to ensure that we stay with you?
I want to get to one last quick phone caller before we run out of time. John's in Stanford. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you doing this morning?
Good. What's up?
Well, I want to say that I'm quite frankly disappointed that the NPR seems to be obsessed with supporting the progressive doctrine and Hillary in particular with that objectivity. The fact is that Trump hit a nerve when he suggested that black America has been mired in the stale politics of lackluster performance in our cities. If you take a city like Chicago or Bridgeport or any number of other cities, you'll see the crime rate and the disproportionate amount of unemployment. And Hillary doesn't seem interested in addressing it. Her programs are basically more of the same. And people are ready for change, and it's simply not going to come. And I think, unfortunately, that Hillary's elected, there's going to be the same result as with her husband, that eventually she's going to be impeached because she can't stay out of her own shadow of opportunity for corruption.
Well, hey, John, thank you very much for your phone call. We'll give you the last word on this issue that we've been talking about here. Obviously, there's a lot more to talk about. Hey, Leah, a quick thought, 30 seconds on something that has nothing to do with Hillary Clinton that you're thinking about this week?
Oh, I'm thinking about the Olympics, that the Olympics are over and how amazing it was. There is a great op-ed in the Hartford Current this week by Nikki Duncan, who is a Hartford's own and was a competitive swimmer for many years. And she just writes about race and swimming and the Simones and how fantastic they are. And so I encourage everyone to check it out.
So clearly you miss having the Olympics on every day.
Oh,
you,
I do.
You're already missing it. You're already missing
already.
It. Colin, how about you?
I guess I can't do music 2 weeks in a row, though I did go to an amazing concert by Solas last night down at the Kate in Old Saybrook. A couple weeks ago, on behalf of my pastor, Nancy Butler, who has ALS and who can't really speak anymore, I delivered her sermon. It was kind of a sermon that we brainstormed together. But we talked a lot about David in the Bible. And, David was even worse than the two candidates that we have right now in certain ways. But he also knew how to apologize and repent and convince people he was really sorry that he had done things. So one of my projects, I'm on vacation next week. I'm going to read 1 and 2 Samuel and see if I can use David as a vehicle for understanding the current race.
Okay, the Olympics, the Bible. You got 20 seconds, Bill. Give us something good.
I know that the great Mary Chapin Carpenter is due back into Infinity Hall soon. And it's always a good time to thank Dan Hanks for everything they've done in that venue to make this a better community, to bring in wonderful entertainment both in Hartford and Norfolk. People should go for that or 100 other shows.
Eric Lichter and Kerry Powers this weekend in Torrington at the Performance Hub. He's one of our favorite artists here on WNPR, and they are a really beautiful duo together. There's a lot of music to talk about. It's not all politics here with Bill Curry, Leah Wright-Rigger, and Colin McEnroe.
People.
This is The Wheelhouse. Thanks for joining us.